Hi and welcome to A Responsible Day for the 19th day of Nisan, which is the third or fourth day of Chol HaMoed, depending on whether you're in Israel or not. Happens to be the responsum we're going to study today is Shut Divrei Yatziv Chilek Orach Chaim Simon Reish Tet Zayin, and it's dated the third day of Chol HaMoed Pesach of Tafshin Mem Aleph, which would have been 1981. Now, it happens to be that in many of his tshuvot, the Klausenberger Rebbe tells you where he is, because some of his life was in Netanya, and he set up Kiryat Sanz in Netanya, he set up the Laniato Hospital in Netanya, and in some of his life, he was in Union City. I believe that at this point in his life, he was in America, which is why I used it for the 19th of Nisan, because theoretically the third day of Chol HaMoed Pesach might be the 18th of Nisan. It happens to also be true that yesterday's responsa was clearly dated the 18th of Nisan, and let's remember that Chol HaMoed responsa are not as plentiful as other dates are, because Rishivim, many of them take off for Yom Tov, and they're celebrating Yom Tov. So when I found this tshuva, I used it for here, and if that doesn't satisfy you for the date, as they say in Hebrew, Imachem Aslicha, I will have to hope that you will forgive me. So let's thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser, for their assistance in making these shirim available online. And let's jump in. And this is a responsum that's about a custom that I did not remember hearing of, although it's in the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch, so maybe I should have encountered it at some point in my life, but I did not recall it. And in dealing with a minhag that is, even in his world, also not much observed, the Klausenberger enlightens us about many other issues about minhag, about custom, and about things that were going on in his world, in the world of Sanz Klausenberger Chassid. So the starting point is a comment by the Tur in Simon Tuf Tzadi Gimel 493 in Orach Chaim, who reports seeing a written report of a custom that not to do melacha. Now, not to do melacha theoretically means not to act as if it's Shabbos or Yontif. But I think most people think of not to do melacha as meaning not to get involved in work other than hanging around. You know, so it would be like not melacha in the technical sense of you couldn't light a fire, you couldn't turn on, you couldn't light a candle, let's say, to read. It's I don't know, I'm not sure of that, but I think that in these kinds of customs, when people say melacha, they mean more not to get involved in any activities like ordinary work. From Pesach till Atzeret, which, let's remember, Atzeret is the rabbinic way of referring to Shavuot, which is interesting because it reminds us that that according to Chazal, and the Ramban has a beautiful comment in the Bereshit Chumash about it, Shavuot is really the completion of what was started on Pesach, both in history terms, because you left Egypt and then you got the Torah, and also in agricultural terms, because he brought the Omer on Pesach and the Shteh HaLechem, the two loaves of bread, on Shavuot, and it was after the two loaves of bread were brought that the new grains were used in the Beit HaMikdash for sacrifices. In any case, so from then, from Pesach till Shavuot, from Shkia, from sunset, Ad Shacharit, until the morning, they would do malacha. The whole night, people wouldn't do malacha. And the reason that the Tur gave was Mishum Talmidei Rabbi Akiva Shemetu, the same reason that many of us don't go to weddings, that almost everybody doesn't go to weddings for some period of time within the Sfira. This was the whole Sfira. But the custom that we have of not getting haircuts, not going to weddings, and all that is because of the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva that's reported in the Gemara. So this custom had it that they passed away close to sunset, and then they would be buried after sunset, and everybody wouldn't do anything other than, and that's why I think it's not like a halachic standard of bitul malacha. Nobody would be involved in anything else, because they'd be busy being involved in the sad task of escorting these students to their final resting place. So that's one source of the custom. Now, there are others who count, there are other reasons, another reason that's given for the custom is that there are people who count the Omer after Shkia, and the pasuk, the verse that talks about counting the Omer, speaks about Sheva Shabbatot Temimot Tiyana, that refers to Sfiras HaOmer, to the period of Sfiras HaOmer, as seven. Now, Shabbatot means weeks, but this custom suggested that it also means the word Shavuot, like Shabbat is a time for what we often call rest, which is a very loose term, but a time for desisting from activities. I mean, it's not Shavuot, but Lashon Shemitah, and also when the Torah talks about the Shemitah year. So Shemitah year is every seventh year you had to leave the land and not work it in various ways. So there too, the Torah speaks about Sheva Shabbatot. I think there it's actually about Yovel, but he says Shemitah. It talks about seven Sabbaths of years, right? So seven Shemitahs would make up a Yovel. So there too, Mashnata Shemitah. Oh, so I'm sorry. So it refers to the Shemitah as a Shabbat, because it says, Sheva Shabbatot Hashanim, then you'll get to the Yovel. So it refers to the Shemitah as a sort of Shabbat. Just like Shemitah, you don't do Malacha, and there, obviously, it's not all Malacha, it's only the Malachas that have to do with working the land. So too, during Svira, you don't do Malacha at the time of the Svira, it would seem to be. By the time of the Shulchan Aruch, when he reports, when he gets to the same spot, and this is now in paragraph 4 of that Siman, he reports the custom as well, but his report is, Nagu Anashim Shalos Lasot Malacha, that it's become a woman's custom, not a general custom, but a woman's custom, not do Malacha from Pesach until Shavuot, and from Shkia and on. Chok Yaakov there comments that it should be true for men as well, but then he points out that there's a commentary on Shulchan Aruch. He says, and I haven't seen people doing it, even the women. So it's not just the men who don't do it. It should be, theoretically, the men just as much as the women. And yet I don't see anybody doing it. Yerucha Shulchan says he knows of women who do it, who keep this custom, who don't do malacha during Sfira after Shkia, after sunset. So the Klausenberger says, it sounds like then it's a minhag that depends on the place that you live in. It's not like a psak in Shulchan Aruch. It's a custom, and the custom developed, and some places do it, some places don't. And that's the language of other people as well. Sounds like that. It's not an obligation. Meaning, so the person is asking him, saying, I see this in Shulchan Aruch, should we make sure to do this? And his answer is, no, you don't have to make sure to do this, because it's whoever has the custom. So in his places, the Klausenberger says, wherever I've been, I've never seen it. And I never saw my ancestors, you know, my fathers, and my family. So it's not a custom that we have in our world, as it were. Then he points out that the Shibbol HaLeket, when he reports the custom, he says there are places where women don't do the malacha because of the death of the students of Rabbi Akiva. And he says in some places, they have the custom not to get haircuts after Pesach for this reason. And so the Shibbol HaLeket, the Klausenberger says, it sounds like what the Shibbol HaLeket means is that there are different customs about this, what to do to commemorate the passing of the students of Rabbi Akiva, and therefore, since in our custom is, and this is true for all of us, not just the Klausenbergers, right, our custom is not to get haircuts, it seems like that's good enough. So his basic conclusion is, you have a report of a custom in the Shulchan Aruch, we don't know people who do it, or he doesn't know people who do it, and the people person asking the question seems to be worried about that. He says, it's an interesting point, he says there's evidence that this is a custom that's not a broad all of Jewish people custom. It's a custom that was appeared in some places. In those places they kept it. In other places they didn't keep it. Where they don't keep it, they don't keep it. And the way they do, they do. And then he says, and by the way, if you're worried that we're not keeping it so we should be keeping it, it's also plausible that there were different forms in which the custom to commemorate the passing of the students of Rabbi Akiva took. Meaning, if the custom fundamentally was, we have a report in the Gemara, we have an idea in the Gemara that these students died in this period of time, so we want to note that and learn from that, hopefully, and mark their passing, then the custom arose to do that in one of two ways. Maybe in both ways, but the original, but the Shibbol HaLeket gives the sense that as long as you're doing one of them, you're okay. And since we don't have weddings in that period, we don't take haircuts in that period, that would seem good enough. Another issue with this custom is that the Torah reports the custom as after Shkia, after sunset, until the morning. So the Taz points out, but if the reason is that it's a time for counting the Omer, you don't want to miss counting the Omer, then as soon as you count, you should be okay. And then if it was about burying the students also, it should be the same thing. Once you bury them, it should be that you're okay to do Malach. And then the Klausenberger says that the Eliyahu is a commentary, of Shulchan Aruch as well. He says also, from the Torah it sounds like it's a Dol Shacharis, but both reasons doesn't sound like that. So the Shulchan Aruch Rab and the Mishnah Berurah both agree that after you count, you should be able to do Malacha. And the Shaar Tzion there says that if you want to follow the Rabbi Akiva student's reason, you should only wait after sunset long enough to bury somebody. Now that's an interesting time period to talk about. Does he mean to bury somebody as if they were in your backyard? Or in each place you'd have to wait as long as it would take to get to a cemetery and bury somebody? Like, it's unclear, because it's unclear custom. So in any case, he thinks that the idea of waiting till the morning is hard to understand, and there's sources that suggest that you wouldn't have to wait that long anyway. So then the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, which was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rishtin Zalman of Liadi, who also wrote the Tanya, and the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is, I think, the accepted Shulchan Aruch for Lubavitcher Chassidim, and it's an important halachic work. He writes there that women who don't count, then it's possible that they should wait the whole night, right? So the idea would be then that their custom, either if it's for the Rabbi Akiva students or for the Sfiras Omer people, if it's for the Sfiras Omer issue, since they don't count, then they should wait. So, but then you don't understand why they're waiting, because they're not really waiting for anything, because they're not going to count ever. So it might be that since they're not counting, we want them to mark the idea of Sfira, and Sfira applies to the night mostly because that's when you make a bracha on it. Something like that, I guess, is what he was suggesting. So if that's true, says the Klausenberger, says Rabbi Yekutiel Yehuda, Yekutiel Yehuda was correct. I looked it up. So he then says that might only be the whole custom. Might only be, that it's for women who have the custom to count. Meaning, he's going to now reverse it. Meaning, we just said Shulchan Aruch suggests maybe women who don't count should wait the whole night, but. The Klausenberg now is going to say, well, maybe the other way around, actually. Although maybe he thinks the Shulchan Aruch meant this. Maybe he might think the Shulchan Aruch meant in places where the custom of most women is to count, but there are women who don't count, they don't do malacha the whole night because they should be counting. So he points out that many women have the custom to count. Magen Avraham talks about it. The Minchas Chinuch talks about it, it in later times. And I know this halacha a little bit because many, many years ago, in later times, some use this as a suggestion for a source that they could make women have a complete obligation to mitzvos, and that can let women be rabbis and all that kind of stuff. So that in Magen Avraham actually becomes a topic in our day of how to understand it. And I wrote an article about it many, many years ago in Tradition Magazine in the late 1980s or something. But Magen Avraham and Machlokes Chinuch are already aware of the idea that many women have the custom to count. So maybe in that realm, in that world, they prohibited them from malacha ad sheyisperu. They stopped them from doing anything else. Like we have many halachot, there really are halachot that not many people observe, but there are halachot that say things like, if you haven't davened Maariv yet, you shouldn't do anything until you daven Maariv. So it gets complicated, because if you have a regular minyan you go to, then maybe you are allowed to. It's complicated, it's not our topic, because it's not an our tshuva, but the idea would be that you stop them from doing anything else, because you're worried about them getting caught up in something else, so they'll count. If that's true, then he says that our women, meaning Klausenberger Hasidisha women, who don't count Sfira, then there's no reason to stop them from doing malacha, especially since you first do a Gemara in Kedubot, Daf Nun Ten Amud Bet, which I'll allow you to look up, that talks about all the problems with Batala. Not his main topic, it's just a throwaway comment, and I won't tell you all things it leads to. It leads to very negative things, and it's a reminder of the Gemara thought, where I didn't trust people, not particular people, it wasn't looking down on particular people, but people in general. When people have nothing better to do, they get into trouble. You know, in English you say, what do you say? Idle hands make for the devil's work or something like that is the English thing. And the Gemara has that already, that idea that batala is a problem. So you certainly don't want, this isn't about women, it's about batala in general. But women too. You don't want to leave women just doing nothing all night for the nights of Sfira, especially if they're not going to count anyway. There's no reason to, he says, and therefore that we shouldn't do that. He also says, and by the way, back in their times, when men went to learn, they would often be golelim kom Torah. There was a long-standing custom for many, many years, in many centuries, where men would get married, and then would go to yeshiva, and yeshiva would be away from the wife, and be away for a while. Now, Rabbi Akiva is the first example of this, who seems to have been away for years and years and years, although I don't know, reading those stories as an adult, if they're really meant to be as extreme as they sound, that he really completely wasn't around, but there's some of that. But certainly in later times, you'd have men who would be married, and they'd go away to learn, and their wife wouldn't come with them. So the point of that is that in those women whose husbands are away, if they don't do malacha all night during the night of Sfira, forget the batala issue, forget the idleness issue, there wouldn't be anything bad about it necessarily, because there's nothing wrong. It's not going to affect the husband at all. But nowadays, he says, if women don't work all those nights, so he says, alul sheyikarem bitul Torah l'habal. It's likely that it will lead to the husband to learn less. Now, I'm not sure what he means by that. One possibility is that he means if the women don't do work, they won't make money, and they're, you know, supporting the husband, the husband will need more money, and they won't be able to learn as much. That might be what he means, although I'm not sure that after Shkia, between Pesach and Shavuot, is such a crucial time for work, that would affect the family's livelihood so much. That might be what he means, but I'm not sure. The other possibility that springs to mind is if the woman's not doing anything, so there might be stuff around the house that needs to get done, and the husband will be called upon to do it, or she might be around doing nothing and she'll expect to come spend time with her. I'm not exactly sure what he meant, but he seems to worry that since men are now living with their wives, even while they're learning, that if women stop doing malacha, stop doing their involvements during the period from Pesach to Shavuot after sunset, that would lead to some kind of the husband's not doing as much Torah, learning as much Torah. Not exactly sure why. Those are the options that I can think of. The other worry, though, is the one that really struck me, because I'd never known this about Klausenberger Hasidim. He says it's also possible that if we tell them they can't do anything all night, and they have stuff they want to do, right? If you have a schedule in life, you have things you want to accomplish, so you schedule your day, you usually include after sunset, you have stuff you're going to do until your day ends, whenever that would be. So he says a worry would be if we tell women they cannot do melacha, they can't work, they can't be involved in their usual involvements all night because they're not counting, then they might say to us, so we'll count. So why is that bad? He says, and I really had never known this before, he says that the Chacham Tzvi, and I never know this about the Chacham Tzvi, now the Chacham Tzvi, let's remember, is somebody who grew up in an Ashkenazic background, but at the age of 16 was sent to Salonika, which is in Greece, which was from Sephardi origins, to learn their Derech Halima, their way of learning, and he sort of adopted a lot of being a Sephardi, and that's why he's called Chacham Tzvi, because instead of calling rabbi, as Ashkenazim did, the term of respect for a Torah scholar in Sephardi communities was Chacham. So he was Chacham Tzvi. Ashkenazi is his last name, because when he got to Salonika, they referred to him as the Ashkenazi. So he's known as Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi, his son is Rav Yaakov Emden. Apparently, the Chacham Tzvi was quoted in a sefer called in the Yeshuos Yaakov, who said that women shouldn't make brachos on mitzvos aseh shazman grama. So that, let's remember, mitzvos aseh shazman grama is a category of mitzvot where there's a time component to the obligation. It's an obligation with a time component. Just somebody just asked me about this recently. Let's say tefillin. Since, for sure, we don't wear tefillin on Shabbat or Yom Tov, that's a debate in the Gemara, but we don't. We also don't wear tefillin at night. So tefillin becomes a mitzvot aseh shazman grama. It is an obligation with a time component. Sitting in a sukkah only happens on the opposite obligation at sukkah's time. That's a obligation with a time component to it. So there's a debate among the Rishonim as to whether women should make brachot on that. They're clearly not obligated to do these mitzvot. They're clearly allowed to do these mitzvot. So even Svardim, who follow the opinion of the Rambam, they don't have a problem with women performing these mitzvot. They only have a problem with women making brachot on these mitzvot. Now, turns out the Chacham Tzvi held that women shouldn't make brachot. Now he would have held this, I guess, because he learned his Friday Shivot, and he became convinced by their perspective. It's not the Ashkenazi custom. The Ashkenazi custom is to follow the ruling of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam had said women make brachos on these mitzvot as well when they fulfill them. So the Klausenberger referred to Zekeni HaKadosh. Again, I never remember if the sons of Rebbe was his grandfather or great-grandfather. I feel like the years are that it should be his great-grandfather, but I'm not positive. So he refers to his grandfather, great-father, the sons of Rebbe, who had said that Al Pi Kabbalah, you know, by mystical tradition, there's a reason with every mitzvah to say Shalom Grandma that women shouldn't do it. So that's a very, very new idea that I don't know of from other sources, which is surprising. Chacham Tzvi, I understand, he's ruling. He's saying we should follow the Rambam's ruling. He thinks that's the more correct ruling. We should follow it. So that would be an example of an Ashkenazi, although he learned in Sephardi Yeshivot, importing a Sephardi Psak into his Ashkenazic life. That's surprising, but not astounding. Right? And then it would lead you to not want them to make brachot. But the Sons or Hasidim, apparently, got the tradition that women shouldn't do these mitzvot. And he quotes somebody else who says that women shouldn't count Sfiras Omer. And therefore, he says, that's why we prefer the women to work during that period of time. Because if we told them that he can't work, they would want us to count Sfira. We don't want them to count Sfira. Why don't we want them to count Sfira? Because in our tradition, we think there's somebody. He doesn't tell us what the reasons are, so we can't get into it. I'm not positive that I would be particularly convinced by them, but a reminder that in this series, we're learning from great Torah scholars, even if they don't always say all that which we would apply into our own lives necessarily. So he is saying that they have a tradition in Sons of Hasidim that positive commandments, and perhaps especially Sfirat HaOmer, women shouldn't do, especially the bracha, because their tradition is, that women don't make brachot, when they fulfill mitzvah aseh shazman grama, obligation to the time component. And for many, it's not actually such a big deal, because for most men in our times, now he's living in a world where this is true, I'm not sure it's true in the world of people that I know, he says, Shkia is around the time they go to shul for mincha, and they tend to stay, especially in the time of the year when it's Sfira in Israel for sure, but in some places in America too, you'll make Marv a little bit later, because you want to have Marv be after the stars come out, because you prefer to count Sefirah after the stars come out. So he says generally men, or you'll say it early, but you'll say it in shul. He says, so generally men won't come back from shul until after Sefirah, until they've counted. And then once they've counted, there's no reason why they shouldn't do malacha if the reason is about the worry about counting Sefirah elsewhere. And also he says, if we were to institute or reinstitute this custom, they can't do malacha until they count, they might count early and way or too early, before Shkia even, just because they know they have to get back to work. And he has a tshuva, he tells us, that we're not going to see now or today, about why it's so vital that you should make sure to count Sefirah after Tseis. So that's a topic of its own that we're not going to get into today, but that the Shulchan Aruch says that in times of stress, if you want to count, or if a community's counting before Tseis, before the stars come out, but after the sun sets, that's acceptable, and then maybe you count later without a bracha, just in case. So the sons of Klausenberger apparently felt that that was a problem, and that really, really people should be careful to count after Tseis. So that would mean you go to shul for mincha, you wait 20 minutes in shul, maybe, I think it's 20 minutes, maybe it's a half hour after mincha, and then you daven marav, and then you can say Sefirah after the stars are already out. And then you solve this problem of this malacha issue, of this question of being involved in other things, because you'll already have counted the omer. Then he offers another idea that could be that the whole custom arose according to those opinions that Sefirah to Omer in our times is an obligation at a Torah level. That's another debate that's worth keeping in mind and thinking about. The obligation to count the omer in the Torah itself. We count the omer literally from when we offered the omer. On the second day of Pesach, you would offer the omer offering, which was a barley offering of the new barley, of the new harvest in the Beit HaMikdash. You'd offer it, and then you'd count from there 49 days, and then you'd offer Shtei Alekhem. That day would be Shavuot, and then that would be Sefirah HaOmer. So if that's the model, then you could argue, and many poskim do, and the Klausenberger thinks it's Rov HaPoskim, it's the majority of poskim. Many authorities hold that when you don't have the Omer offering, you can't have a Sefirah. You can have it, but it's only it's a rabbinic institution to commemorate what we used to have when we had a Beit HaMikdash. There are opinions, I think the Rambam is one of them, there are opinions that hold that it's still a right to obligation, that it's still a biblical obligation. The Torah just said, count this time period from the day after Pesach, after the first day of Pesach, after the holiday of the first day of Pesach, from the 15th, from after the 15th of Nisan, count from then, and count 49 days. So if it's a d'oraita, then you can imagine instituting this rule that you don't do malacha because you're worried people will forget to count the Omer. So to guard that will make sure to observe a mitzvah d'oraita, a biblical obligation, it makes sense and it's a common practice to institute things to make sure that we don't forget these kinds of things. But according to most authorities, he says, who thinks it's Rabbanan, so, and he looks at it, you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, you see it, maybe that's the reason why this minhag has also become, has gotten to be treated lightly, because it's not so significant, because after all, it's a rabbinic issue. So, again, now the rabbinic issues are a light matter, but that in terms of instituting safeguards to make sure we don't forget, that's much less significant of a thing, of a practice, when it comes to rabbinic obligations. And it also makes it, he says, less plausible to compare it, like we started out with, by comparing it to Shabbos, which is Shemitah, where we said it's Sheva Shabbatot, it's referred to Shabbatot, but if it's a Derabbanan issue, then it's less based directly on the Pesukim, it's more of a Derabbanan to commemorate, and then that parallel somewhat falls apart as well. So that is the response of the Klausenberger Rebbe regarding this custom. And I brought it up not because, again, the custom isn't one that most of us keep, so that wasn't the reason to bring it up. I thought it was worth doing. First of all, again, this is a hard time of year because there aren't that many tshuvot written. We're going to see briefly another one written by Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen of Jerba, who we see only occasionally because I find his tshuvot long. I don't know, something about his tshuvot hasn't always resonated with me. I'm not sure why. It's probably my own fault, but we have a couple minutes left, so I have a brief tshuva of his also from this time period. But other than him, most people just didn't write on Chol HaMoed Pesach. So here's another tshuva for the third day of Chol HaMoed Pesach. This is from the year Tafresh Ayin Chet 5678, which would have been 1918. And since he lived in Jerba his whole life, I know that this is from the 19th of Nisan. And the question was, this is from Shit Shoel V'Nishal Chelek Dalid, fourth volume, the Orach Chaim section, Simon Chaf Hey, response from 25. And the question was, somebody bought some flour before Pesach, and he shipped it by sea to where he's living, and he wasn't thinking about it before Pesach. He didn't remember that it was on the boat, and he's flour on the boat, and then he remembers, well, it's already Pesach. So what do you do with that flour? So let's remember that flour is probably not chametz, depending on how the flour was prepared. So the Rav Kaufman Moshe HaKohen points out, and let me throw something out there. My email address is grothst@gmail.com. And this responsa, and many of his responsa, I checked, like 90 of his responsa, he signs as Ayin He, that's a Rosh Tevot, that's an acronym for something, I'm not sure. Ha Mem Chaf, another acronym, I'm not sure what it means. And then Silto, which means Sephardi Tahor, something like that. So I am looking for understanding as why he signed his response that way. There was the Bar Ilan response and didn't know. If you know, please feel free to email me. I think it might be something like Eved Hashem, I don't know what. Anyway, Hamechakeh Kates or something, but I'm not sure. So, back to the tshuva though. The Rashbat, he points out there's a tshuva of Rosh Hashanah Duran, who says that if you have wheat or grain, that water fell onto it. So, theoretically, that's nothing. It's just water on grain. But the Gemara has a debate as to whether, see, if you throw water on grain and you just leave it, and you leave it there forever, it will pop open in a way. It'll break open. And that is a sign of the beginning of chimutz, or the beginning of leavening. And we worry about that maybe that's already been a chimutz you have to worry about. So the Gemara has a debate when the water falls in the grain, to be worried about it halachically, for us to have a halachic requirement to worry about it, do you need that you see the bikia, the breaking open of the grain? Or as long as you were to put it onto something hot and then it would open up, that would be enough that you would have to get rid of that chametz, and there's no that grain. There's no psak there. So that's a suffik, and it's a derabbanan, because this is a derabbanan issue of chametz. It's not a deraita biblical version of what chametz is, and therefore we can go lekula. Now, Rav Chalfon Moshe Cohen says, Chametz Shavala V'Pesach, the problem of using Chametz that was owned by a Jew after Pesach, that's also Durabana. That's a debate in the Gemara, but we assume that it's a rabbinic issue, and we have a general worry, we have a general principle that worries Durabanan, rabbinic issue worries, we can act in the lenient way. Lefize, lo nitpaka, and if we don't know that the grain that was used to make this flour had popped open in this way, then you should be able to use it after Pesach. If it had popped open in that way, then you wouldn't be allowed to, and you could sell it, but you could sell it to a goy. Why could you sell it to a goy, to a non-Jew? The chametz of a Pesach is a knas, is a fine that you violated bal yirah and bal yimatzeh. So you could say, well, this guy too violated. Now, I have to say, I think in many other psakim, we do assume that. We assume that even if a person didn't know, even if it was an ones, but this, Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen says, there's no reason to be kones to this guy, because what could he have done? He was an anus. That's step one of his defense of this guy. So I'm not sure that other people pass him this way, but step two, I think, is a more applicable one. He says it also, before Pesach, he was mevatel. We all say this formula, we don't want to own any chametz in Pesach. Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen says, that bittul should work, that you don't want to own it, at least at a doraita level. And he says that it works even for chametz that's out there and known to be yours, but you didn't remember at the time. It doesn't matter. When you say those words, you intend broadly any chametz you own, and that should suffice. So again, we have this flour. We don't know if the grain that went into it had ever had any water put on it. So that's always a problem today with bleach flour. I think the grain gets water on it, and therefore we have a problem with it, and therefore we often say not to keep such grain or to sell such grain, such flour, even though it's just flour, meaning theoretically flour is just ground up wheat. But if water got on it, then you have to worry about it. So step one is you have to worry about it, but it's not necessarily a chametz. And step two was, even if you have to think that by the virtue of the fact that it was shipped by sea, it must have gotten water on it, and therefore it's likely a problem, it's mostly a rabbinic problem. So step two is that since it's mostly a rabbinic problem, you might be able to ignore it. Step three was, he thinks if you're an anus, that helps not needing to be kones to God. Not that it's not chametz or it's not a problem, but that the issue of the knas, the fine that Chazal levied for having owned chametz over Pesach, then maybe that didn't apply. And then the last step is, and also the bittul that Jews say, the nullification of chametz they say before Pesach, should be good enough even when the chametz was out there and the guy didn't, the owner didn't specifically think about it when he or she made the bittul. So if the flour only got there in the ship after Pesach, Rav Chalfon Moshe HaKohen thinks he's a complete honest. Now, I think he could have sold it, probably, but he thinks he's a complete honest. It was against his will. There's nothing he could do about it, and therefore, he's got all these reasons to say that you can use the chametz. because all of the reasons we said, I'm not going to go over them again. But if it got to the city by ship in the course of Pesach, I mean, the ship lands, you know, in the Chol HaMoed, so there it's more of a Sfeika Delraita, because he might have been in actual physical possession. That's part of what he's trying to suggest when he says he's an honest. You shouldn't own it. He thinks it would be that you own it in a physical way where you have physical access to it. So that he thinks might be a rabbinical, biblical issue, and therefore he thinks you might have to paskin l'chumra, despite all the other suggestions he had made. He thinks you might have to be stringent about that issue. In this particular case, he thinks there's another room for leniency, because the way they made the flour in those cases was you didn't wait. Sometimes you would wait to soften up the wheat before grinding it, but here you didn't do any waiting. You might have washed off the dirt from it, but then you ground it up immediately. So then, there's no real suffix that maybe it had leavened. Maybe it had already popped open and started the leavening process. He thinks that the way that we make flour today doesn't allow for that. He notes that he's not like learning the issue right now, but his reaction is that for all the reasons we've said before, he doesn't think you have to worry, and you can use the chametz after Pesach. And then there's a little bit more here, but I want to skip most of it. I just want to point out that he notes that the Shulchan Aruch writes that if you have a real problem, Mishadat Chag, one is allowed to buy flour in the marketplace. Meaning, we don't know that this flour is specifically made for Pesach Deni whatsoever, but we're allowed to generally buy flour in the marketplace in order to have matzah for the mitzvah of Seder night. So you would have thought you have to have Shmuel, so ideally you do. But if you have no other options, for whatever reason, you know, all the matzah got burned up and you have to get new matzah. So you can buy flour in the marketplace. And the Taz wrote, that's even in a place where they had the custom to wash the wheat and maybe even soak it a little bit to get all the dirt off, and you have to have some worry that maybe it had popped open and started the leavening process, but we say that no, they don't wash it in such a way, and therefore Bishat HaKlach, you knew that. And that helps us assume that the flour that this man got shipped to him also had never become Chametz. So, for the 19th day of Nisan, the third day of Chol HaMoed Pesach outside of Israel, and the fourth day of Chol HaMoed Pesach in Israel, a responsive day, we had the Klausenberger Rebbe on this interesting custom not to do any malacha after Shkia, after sunset, and the reason why he didn't want that custom being kept, and the reasons he gave for it, and what he thinks about women and observance of certain mitzvos. And then we had very briefly Rav Chalfa Moshe Cohen talking about what happens when flour has been shipped to you over Yontif, over Pesach, and you forgot that you own such flour, whether you're allowed to use it after Pesach. With thanks to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hachhauser, responsive day 19th of Nisan, I'm Gideon Rothstein. Have a great day, and Achag Kasher V'Sameach.